Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. So let's start with an alert that I think is a part of a growing issue. So let's talk about that growing issue, and that's hair growth vitamins. A lot of people, as they age, notice thinning and perhaps deterioration in terms of the number of active hair follicles. People who have a maternal male relative with male pattern baldness are likely to experience hair thinning. Many will not go bald. Women would tend to have a sort of diffuse thinning. But nobody likes that change, or at least very few people do. And so I wanted to point out that those formulas and supplements that are advertised to help with hair growth, not so much the topical ones, but the hair growth vitamins, contain a potential issue. And most doctors don't know about this or forget about it at critical moments. And that's one of the ingredients that you often find at very high levels in these vitamins, a B vitamin known as biotin. Now, biotin is quite harmless and you can take very large doses of it. But the problem is that those doses, as with all B vitamins, they come out in the urine in fairly short order. Anyone who takes a B vitamin complex will notice that they have a very bright, cheerful urine color for about 4 hours after they take their pill. That's how fast it gets through the system. Now, of course, a lot of it does get absorbed. But B vitamins are things that we need on a regular basis. We can't synthesize them. And there are many interesting multisyllabic deficiency diseases associated with B vitamin deficiency. However, they can have a bad effect on lab tests. They can make lab tests less accurate. And some of these tests are tests that are done all the time in clinical medicine. And the ironic thing about the tests are that the biotin can actually make the results look too high or too low. And so it just messes up the focus of these lab tests. So I'm going to read you a list of the tests that are noted to be affected by biotin. And if you're taking large doses of hair growth vitamins and you've got a physical coming up, I strongly recommend that you stop taking them for at least 48 hours before you get those blood draws for your physical examination blood tests. So here's the list. Thyroid function tests, including TSH, the thyroxine, which is T4, the triiodothreonine, the T3, all of these can be affected. Troponin tests, and these are used to diagnose heart attacks. I learned about this when in this context, but then when I checked it out further with my friend Claude, I learned all this other stuff. So the one for biotin and the heart attack test, troponin, is worrisome because it causes falsely low levels. So if you go to the emergency room with chest pain, one of the things that they're almost certain to do is run a troponin. And if you have high levels of biotin on board, you might get a false negative, a normal troponin level, when actually there's heart enzymes that are leaking into your bloodstream that would tell the doctor that you're in danger of damage to your heart or already have some. A second one that's quite significant is parathyroid hormone, which can also be affected. Parathyroid hormone is often checked when a person has osteoporosis. People can have tumors that are not malignant, but they make extra parathyroid, and it's a stealth problem. The people lose calcium from their bones, and often the first finding is a fracture. So this is important. We don't routinely check parathyroid unless we see a high calcium, but it's possible to have a slow leak and have normal calcium in your bloodstream. Follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone, which are used to diagnose menopause and certain kinds of male infertility, will not show, will be altered. Vitamin D can go either way. Biotin interference can lead to either a falsely increased or a decreased level of 25-hydroxyvitamin D. And that is really substantial. Many regular listeners will recall that I'm a strong advocate of getting those vitamin D levels up high. It's a master immune regulator and anti-inflammatory. We know it's protective for COVID and probably for other viruses, or at least the runaway severity that a cytokine storm can cause with other viral infections. Probably, although I have not seen data on this, also maybe puts a cap on the damage that might come from sepsis. Although, like I said, that's a speculation on my part, and I'll have to fact check this. Testosterone and PSA, tests that are commonly done for men, also can be affected. Ferritin, which is a iron storage hormone, but it also goes quite high when you have a bacterial infection. It's a marker for inflammation. So these are all really important things. I think the simplest thing to do is skip it before lab draws for 48 hours. I guarantee your hair will not fall out. And also, maybe just take a moment if you're in the emergency room and make sure the ER doctor knows that you're taking this big wonking dose of 5 or 10 milligrams of biotin. You probably need, you know, 1/1,000th of that to avoid a deficiency disease. But high doses of it do seem in studies to improve hair growth. So I'm not saying don't do it. I'm just saying proceed with caution. Well, going to our first listener letter, this is from Benjamin, who says that he lives west of the Rockies. KG Benjamin, keep it low profile. It's good. And I just want to say that Benjamin sent his letter by going to askdrdon.com and clicking the Contact Us button. So I want to encourage people to consider that option as well. Benjamin writes, longtime listener, first time caller. My wife is pregnant with our first. Congratulations. We received some new pots and pans for our wedding. They claim to be this new nonstick ceramic based technology that is non-toxic, BPA free, blah, blah, blah. Specifically, we have pots and pans by Green Pan with Thermalon technology and Caraway baking pans. We're millennials and feel burned by the promise of nonstick kitchenware that a decade later turns out to be poisonous. I'm worried about these new wares that toot the same promises with the new made-up trademark names. All of these products contain caution users against abrasive cleaning and too high of heat. Do you have an opinion about these types of cookware? Is the convenience worth the risk of some future discovery of toxicity? Or were the first-generation failures of nonstick just that, first-gen mistakes that have been solved in later iteration? Is proper use and cleaning enough to safeguard my young family, or should I stick to cast iron and stainless steel? Well, before I launch into answering your question, Benjamin, I want to tell you that I, too, became very concerned when those early reports about Teflon came out and about the forever chemicals and the PFOA, and I switched as soon as something better came along. And that was a product called ScanPan. And this nonstick coating, and a very good coating it is, I will say, it's called Stratanium. And this is a quote-unquote patented PFOA, PFOS-free nonstick coating system that they spent over 2 years researching and testing before releasing in 2017. Now, some sources claim that ScanPan uses a ceramic titanium nonstick coating that's free of PFOA and PTFE, probably what the Thermalon says. Other sources suggest that it's actually a hybrid Teflon ceramic nonstick coating reinforced with titanium, where the ceramic and the titanium serve to make that Teflon coating stronger and longer lasting than other types of Teflon nonstick. And this company does acknowledge that they do contain Teflon, I believe, or PTFE, depending on what term you want to use. Believe me, when we purchased ours, that was not on the package. The coatings have always been made without the use of PFOA. One of the reasons Teflon is bad is octanoic acid, that's PFOA for short, as known to be toxic. It's used in the manufacture of Teflon. And when Teflon is overheated to about over 600, which is easy to do if you leave it on the stovetop, it releases a gas that contains residue of PFOA, as well as some other interesting things I'll tell you about in a moment. So ScanPan finally fessed up about the Teflon in their pan, and it has to be heated to 660 for the coating to break down. The fumes that are emitted are harmless for humans but harmful for birds. Yeah, we've heard that before, haven't we? Teflon itself breaks down at about 500 and does release toxic chemicals into the air that can cause something called polymer fume fever. You also get this if you burn things in zinc containers. That's called metal fume fever. It's a flu-like illness. It's basically a poisoning. Your body deals with it, but how sure are we that it's okay? So basically, the same as you said, the nonstick cookware recommendations: don't use high heat, never preheat an empty pan. The opposite, by the way, of the advice for using an iron skillet. Ensure good kitchen ventilation and use soft tools to prevent scratching the pan. Now, ScanPan claims their coating is metal utensil safe. It probably is. What about Thermalon? Is a different compound that does not contain the PFOA, but it does have some issues, particularly when you look at the real things that are in there. So Thermalon is silicon dioxide. That's basically sand. And it's complexed with something else that's, according to the ads, completely toxin-free. However, there was a lawsuit in 2019 that was settled out of court with prejudice to the person who brought the suit, which means they got paid off on the promise of never filing another lawsuit. It's a little fishy. It's probably safe as long as you don't scratch it. And that, I think, is the most important lesson to take home here. You've got to be careful with scratching these things, because once you scratch them, whatever complex is on top of them that's protecting you from the compound is no longer there. And it's new and not studied. So getting back to your question about the caraway, this is one that I actually think is probably safe. This is cookware, so things that you would bake in, not fry in. And of course, the difference between a skillet and baking is that you aren't really scratching away at the surface. Presumably, you are not eroding or abrading it, but if there were chips, I'd be concerned. Caraway has an aluminum alloy. They don't reveal what's in the alloy. That's under the ceramic coating. And you can also get cast iron with the ceramic coating, which helps make it a little less sticky. But I've wanted for a while to switch to cast iron, and I want to thank you for kind of giving me a little kick to do that. Cast iron pans are pretty safe under most circumstances. People, again, you don't really want to abrade it, and you want to make sure that it is well seasoned. And seasoning, you know, when you heat something and expand it, the metal expands, little pores open up. And then as soon as you clean the pan. You're supposed to clean it immediately after cooking with just hot water, no soap, and then put it back hot on the burner and heat it up again and put some oil. And the oils that are recommended are grapeseed or avocado oil. And those, and then turn off the heat and let it soak in. And that creates a sort of a coating that's temporary. Of course, it cooks off. And so you have to do this every time you cook. But the people I know who cook in cast iron are adamant that it is very nonstick. And I would say with a pregnant wife, you might want to put those away because you just can't be too careful. Your wife are already likely to be exposed to PFOA in the groundwater. It is the reason they call it a forever chemical is because it gets in to the groundwater. And although Teflon does not release this directly, you have to heat it, and then it's very very small trace amounts, but you don't want to breathe it. However, in the manufacturing process, it has gotten into the water table, and just about everybody on the planet has a PFOA level in their blood because most of us drink water. However, you know, PFOA has declined since 2002, and the FDA stopped the use, or the government stopped the use of it in the production of Teflon. Hasn't been used in that since 2013. So most likely it's not releasing that particular acronym. But the real problem here is, well, like BPA, you see all those plastic bottles that say BPA free? Well, that's great. But you know what they have? Instead of bisphenol A, they have bisphenol B or bisphenol C or bisphenol D or other chemicals, which are even less well studied, but based on analysis of their chemical structure, probably fit into the hormone receptors and have the same health issues that we're all concerned about. And this PFOA stuff is nasty. It's definitely got studies showing that it's carcinogenic. It's unfortunately, these PFAs are used in packaged consumer goods. They're lining the linings of certain bags of chips. And according to the CDC, they can raise the risk of certain cancers. They can decrease vaccine response. They're associated with low birth weights in infants. That could be a third variable problem based on the junk diets that the underprivileged people in our country eat. Increased cholesterol, never good. High blood pressure, likewise, never good. And there was one study of workers who were exposed to PFOA at a DuPont plant, and they found a significant association between kidney cancer and the presence of PFOA in the blood of those who died of it. So soft data on cancer. You don't want to breathe this stuff. You don't want to drink any more of it than you have to. And I certainly wouldn't want to burn a pan in the kitchen of a pregnant woman. So maybe you should buy a nice cast iron pan and watch some YouTube videos on how you keep it seasoned. Let's go to our first caller. Tell me your name and where you're calling from.
Well, this is Francis from Santa Cruz.
Hello, Francis.
Hi there. I of course, love your show, and I'm listening to it much more now that I've gotten the KSQD app. I'm often out of our listening area, and now I'm catching more of it. I have a couple of questions. Of course, I enjoy very much your call with Rose Aguilar, which K-Squid broadcasts weekday mornings at 10. She'd been off the air for some months, and when she came back on, she explained to the listeners that she'd been caring for her father. He died 3 months after a diagnosis of what she described as a small cell prostate cancer. It killed him very quickly. And she was talking about his diet. He'd always struggled with weight, and his diet was very poor. You know, a lot of processed meat, a lot of food that we now realize is bad for us. She's been having a lot of guests who've been talking about nutrition. And one in particular got my attention. Her name is Dr. Anne Pittier. Mm-hmm. She's a radiation oncologist, and she's involved with Tacoma Valley Radiation Oncology Centers and the American Institute for, is it Cancer Research? But in any case, she was talking about the values of a plant-based diet, and I've been making efforts to be more aware of what I eat. I do have vegetarian days. I aim for chicken or fish or, salads, blueberries in my oatmeal type thing. But her advice was that really it's any kind of meat is bad for you. I mean, and, she equated, oven cooked salmon with ultra processed lunch meat, and an egg is almost as bad as having a slice of bacon. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to try to get up to speed and try to increase my intake of vegetables. And I think one question I have, I'm not much of a cook, and I wonder if you've come across anything that's the equivalent of a I hate to cook cookbook for eating a vegan or vegetarian diet.
Well, forget about vegan if you hate to cook. I mean, you're going to have to hire a chef. Vegan is very labor intensive. Lots of chopping, and you need to do that chopping in order to be sure that you're absorbing enough of the nutritional content of the food. The raw food diet, same thing. You know, if you're you need to pre-process that food to really be sure you're going to get adequate nutrients. That's depends on the age, of course, but the older we get, the less efficient we are at making stomach acid, and unfortunately we're sort of in a social crisis in this country at the moment, so everyone's stomach is churning and they're not turning out. They're eating, listening to the news. They have a high sympathetic tone. They're sort of in a low level of frantic fight or flight, and that plays havoc on your ability to extract nutrients from plants. So you either end up drinking some apple cider vinegar and chopping things up for vegans. I'm really emphasizing this for vegans more than vegetarians, because vegetarians do get animal products, and vegans don't. So I'm not in favor of a vegan diet so much as we age. I do think that it's just hard to extract the protein in particular from the compounds that are there. It's complexed with a lot of fiber. And so when you look at the intermediates that you see in the bloodstream, or you measure muscle mass, my vegans often come in a bit on the low side in terms of that bell curve for age on their muscle mass. And I link that to fragility and frailty and, you know, sort of the long slide towards the big black box. So I disagree with any kind of extreme view. That's another piece of this. I'm going to say, you know, certain organic meats, organic fish, almost, you know, when I say organic fish, I mean, you know, essentially not farmed, and worry about the large predator fish. In the last 2 years, a friend of mine who's from Argentina has turned me on to smoked sardines, which are delicious and small and very low on the fish food chain, so they contain very little, low levels of accumulated mercury or other toxins. So just saying, that's my content label. Maybe if you visualize a round plate, you want perhaps at least a quarter of that plate to be some kind of high protein food. And so, you know, really well cooked beans works if you tolerate beans. Some people can't handle the lectins, but again, there's a really extreme guy out there who's like, lectins will kill you. And it's like, no, it won't. Humans are very adaptive. You've got to get enough fiber. You've got to feed your microbiome. That's why plant-based diets probably have lower rates of cancer, is because it's the big cancer, right? What's the big cancer? The big cancer is colon. And colon and lung are the big ones in terms of their frequency in the population. And so when you do large epidemiology studies, you do see a benefit. When you break it down by cancer, the majority of that benefit is related to the fact that there's less bowel cancer. So cooking, in terms of your desire to eat more vegetarian meals and not wanting to cook, you live here in Santa Cruz. Through most of the health food stores, and that for us would be New Leaf, Staff of Life, and Whole Foods, have kitchens, and they cook meals. And if you show up at about 5:30, you can get yourself a dinner entree, maybe a little later, but you can get yourself a dinner entree, and you put it in a thing, pay it by the pound, go home and eat it. And this is actually a pretty good strategy. And these are, of course, organic. And so we check that box. And a lot of them are vegetarian, so you get to check that box. And it's pretty low effort. For lunch, you know, you can, you don't need to be gluten-free, but you should be heritage grain, not, you know, Wonder Bread, but I would doubt that you would be the person who'd be eating, you know, Wonder Bread with Skippy on it. You know, buying organic peanuts and then grinding them and having your own peanut butter without any emulsifiers in it. Great idea. Nut butters in general, cashew butter, almond butter, kind of the mainstay of a lot of vegans' diets. And, you know, a jar and a butter knife don't exactly count as cooking. That plus a salad, and again, you can buy boxed washed greens that all you have to do is throw some dressing on. I'm fond of dressings that separate in the bottle, and that's because emulsifiers, even natural emulsifiers, have an adverse effect on your gut mucus, and there are important anti-inflammatory bacteria in your microbiome that actually live on the mucus. So you're taking, it's like you're taking away the food of the thing that you actually want there to be a lot of. And that's never a good plan. So is that helping?
Yes, it is. You know, I mean, from what I'm reading and what I've been hearing from all of these guests that she's been having on, you know, they talk about the dangers of imitation sugars, because then the body has some problem processing real sugar, and the body begins to consume the mucus, and that leaves the gut lining vulnerable, that can lead to cancers. You know, readings about, and, you know, speakers talking about ultra-processed food, and that the problem isn't so much... you know, the problem is all the ultra processing to make food addictively delicious.
Well, you are definitely right about that. That is a big problem.
Yeah. So, but you know, I'm not opposed to cooking. Although, you know, from what I'm reading and from what I've heard, you know, to make a healthy meal is going to take a lot longer than something that's not as good for you. But still, I would like to become more of a cook. Mm-hmm. But you know, all the basic cookbooks I come across are not going to lead me in the right direction.
Actually, you might want to take a look at there's a column in the New York Times that's like the 30-minute meal. And that may not be the exact title, but it's a feature, and they have a lot of stuff in the archives, and they would undoubtedly have vegetarian meals or meals that were healthier and you know, you can look at what's in it and decide if it's on your allowed list of ingredients. I want to comment on the artificial sugar issue. There are a lot of different artificial sugars, and they're all frankenfoods, right? The one that seems to be the safest is stevia. The xylitol and the erythritol have, particularly erythritol, has some implications with heart disease. Saccharin, which was linked to bladder cancer in rats and then has failed to actually associate with cancer in humans, has an aftertaste. And, of course, everybody has their favorite reason to criticize NutraSweet or to criticize Splenda. And I agree with those criticisms, although I think small amounts of those are probably well within the body's ability to metabolize. I tend to try and be all natural sugar, low sugar. If you think about it, granulated sugar is a processed food, right? That's not found in nature. What you can find in nature is honey, and otherwise, once you get into cane sugar or coconut sugar or anything like that, that's a processed food. So if we're going to be pure about the processed food thing, I worry about microplastics in the processing plants. Have you thought about that? I mean, they're factories, right? They chop things up. They run it through pipes. They extrude it through molds. They reshape it. And then they carry it places in large plastic-lined metal tanks and run it through more tubes into the packaging plant. So lots of microplastics are eating food that's processed, even if it's healthy, organic processed food, is something I'm moving away from. And so I'll point out that, like I said, having other people cook your food with good ingredients real time in a kitchen is not such a bad idea. And I like for cooks, and this is something that I've taught to the residents at the hospital, at the family medicine residency program that got started last year and plan to teach it annually, is you spend a couple of hours on Sunday in the kitchen. And while you're there, you maybe make some bone broth in the slow cooker, and you make some grains, barley, quinoa, and you put them in glass containers, no plastic, in the fridge, and you chop up some celery, and you chop up some, grate some carrots, and chop up some onions, maybe make some sauerkraut. You spend a couple of hours just chopping and madeleining and blending stuff, and you store it as separate ingredients, and then throw them into bowls. You come home from work, and it's like, okay, you know, scoop of barley, and I liked that barley with this teriyaki sauce, so I'm going to use that, and I'm going, or maybe Bragg's amino, or whatever, and then you're going to throw in some grated carrots, and you're going to throw in some black beans, and you're going to throw in a few cashews for crunch, and you've got a high protein, completely vegetable based, except for the bone broth, which you might have a cup of heated bone broth on the side to wash it all down. You've got an extremely healthy meal there that probably checks all of the extreme boxes, except, like I said, for the bone broth, and gets you into gets you at the table eating in, you know, what, 7-10 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you. You've given me some great ideas.
You are very welcome, and thank you for calling.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's take a look at what Linnea has to say. She heard the last call and suggested the How Not to Die cookbook. And Linnea, thank you so much. I love crowdsource responses. And so recommending to our last caller that maybe he look into the How Not to Die cookbook. Sounds like a good book to read. And I think there is actually a popular health book called How Not to Die. And of course, if you have a publisher, one thing your publisher will always ask if your first book sells is, can you do a cookbook? Because the cookbook market is one of the most enduring and profitable aspects of book publishing. And ironically enough, so hey, let's go with it. How Not to Die Cookbook. So the next story, we have a few counterintuitive findings in cancer that I found quite fascinating. So when it comes to cancer, aging is a double-edged sword. Age is considered to be and is the most important risk factor for cancer, and that's because genetic mutations build up in cells over years and decades and ultimately drive the development of cancer. I used to describe it as kind of a bingo card where the longer you stay in the bingo game, the more likely you are to get five across. And five across is mutations in all of the oncogenes that are needed to get a cancer rolling. Turns out there's a lot of epigenetic stuff going on as well. So that's where many of the environmental risks come from. We had a natural experiment a few years ago where identical twins were both astronauts. One went to space. One little piggy went to space. The other stayed home. And the one who went to space aged so much faster. And it was all epigenetic aging, presumably from not being protected from radiation. And, of course, the problems with zero gravity and its effect on the body. You'd think it would be good. But actually, zero gravity increases your risk of congestive heart failure because the blood doesn't stay in your legs where it belongs. Instead, it stays in your lungs where it doesn't. So we don't send people with congestive heart failure into space anyway, but we can do animal models, and that's how we learn that one. However, new evidence getting back to cellular aging. This study was published in Nature. It came out of Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And this is about advanced age. Now, as people get older, they're more likely to get cancer. But there's a point when you get so old that your risk of cancer actually begins to fall. So let's take lung cancer for an example. Lung cancer is diagnosed in most people around the age of 70. But once you get to 80 or 85, the incident rate starts to come down. And the research shows that the aging cells actually lose their capacity for renewal and therefore for the runaway growth that happens in cancer. Our previous caller was talking about the small cell prostate cancer, and that's an example of a runaway growth cancer. If you have small cell prostate cancer, most of our therapies won't work, and it's extremely aggressive and moves very fast. And so that was the situation that he was describing. For Rosie Aguilar's father, the findings about the aging cells are also backed up by previous studies looking at prostate cancer epidemiology. The very old men, and we're talking in their 80s, who get prostate cancer tend to have much less aggressive prostate cancers. And this was related to iron, oddly enough. So the analysis showed in this mouse study showed that iron plays a role in aging cells' ability to regenerate. So we've had therapies for cancer that target iron metabolism. And they've worked well in younger people, but they don't work as well in older people. So this was done in a genetically modified mouse model of lung cancer. And they found that as the mice get older, they make more of a protein in their body. It's probably one of those senescent proteins that we talked about last week or the week before. So it's called NUPR1. And NUPR1 changes the settings in the cells, and the cells start acting like they're iron deficient, so they divide more slowly. And oddly enough, the aging cells actually accumulate more iron, but they function like they don't have enough. So since the cells in older mice functioned as if they didn't have enough iron, they lost some of their ability to regenerate. And because regenerate capacity is directly linked to the rise of cancer, because it's when the cells divide that the errors happen that lead to cancer, the mutations and the oncogenes. Older mice got far fewer tumors than their younger counterparts. And they could reverse this by giving the older mice additional iron, or by chemically reducing the amounts of NUPR in their cells. It rejuvenated the cells so that they were more effective cancers. But an offshoot of this is that giving in mice that have damaged lungs, and presumably in people that have damaged lungs, and COVID really damaged a bunch of people's lungs, and they're still having problems with their ability to function. Insufficient lung function doesn't heal. Probably also if you have a pulmonary thrombosis, a pulmonary embolism, you are not necessarily, when you're older, going to heal those lungs. It turns out delivering iron to the lungs as an asthma inhaler has worked really well in mice, and human studies are getting started on that. But iron is really complicated, right? There are a number of therapies I mentioned based on a type of cell death called ferroptosis, and these are the ones that work well in younger people but work less well in older people, because the older cells think that they don't have enough iron, so they respond to the ferroptosis signaling differently. So when we're doing clinical trials, not only do we have to worry about sex and drugs, we also have to worry about age, because this research shows that events that occur when people are young, those cancers are probably more dangerous than cancers occurring later. So key here is preventing young people from smoking or tanning or other obvious carcinogenic exposures. Can we say vaping, anyone? But no, we can't officially. I can just say it unofficially. I worry about vaping and what the other shoe dropping in 5 or 10 years might look like. We already have evidence that certain fluids can definitely mess the lungs up permanently. What about other fluids that are in there that are quote-unquote safe? Again, evidence of absence is different than absence of evidence. We have a caller. Please tell us your name and where you're calling from.
My name is Ian, and I'm calling from Santa Cruz.
Hello, Ian. What would you like to talk about?
Yes. Well, it's something you mentioned, a word you mentioned, and that is lecithin. So I was calling because I experienced information given by a certain doctor. Now, you can't mention his name, can I?
Oh, yeah, I could mention his name. I just couldn't remember it offhand.
It's Dr. Gundry.
That's it, yes.
Yes. So I signed up to his newsletter and all that. I get regular emails. But I stopped when I started researching some of his claims against lecithin. So I'd like you maybe take this opportunity to clear the air about lecithin. Now, my own personal experience has been, and of course, maybe I should tell listeners that he does say that just lecithin is bad for you. Almonds are a culprit, he says, and peas. You got to stay away from foods like this. Even, you know, you hear all the good stuff about blueberries and their antioxidant properties. You can't do blueberries either. So there's another doctor, by the way, that criticizes him online. But I was concerned about his talking about almonds have lecithin, you shouldn't have it, because we make our own almond milk.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked it up, and the lecithins are in the skin. And
right.
So we started blanching the almonds and then making the milk. So again, would you clear up the issue about lecithins?
Sure. I need to back up a little bit and talk about the fact that many things, lectins are a protein. They're made as a defense mechanism for by the plant to keep itself from being eaten, because the plant wants the, for example, the almond, that's a seed, right? So the seed wants to actually plant itself, get into the ground. You know, it has that heavy shell. The idea is it's going to break open and get in contact with the soil and have water and sun and grow a new almond tree. That's the mission of an almond. Now along comes animals, and animals want to eat the almonds, but almonds are pretty hard to open until you start getting humans with rocks, and then suddenly they become a food supply, right? So it's, but there've been primates smashing almonds open with rocks for a very, very long time. So lectins are a defense mechanism. Some lectins are very, very toxic, which is bad. Like the ricin is in castor beans. Do not eat castor beans. You will die. We had a big castor bean tree in the house area where I grew up. We didn't own that house. We could not cut down the tree. So my parents, from the time I could talk, they were like, do not eat those. I was a very fussy eater, so I was not about to eat anything with spikes on it. But that's beside the point. They knew that they had a poison around, and they were trying to keep their kids safe. But a little bit of poison is actually good for you. So the main reason that ricins are considered bad is not because they are toxic, but because they are anti-nutrients and they can interfere with the absorption. So you'll sometimes read about goitrogens, right? So if Brussels sprouts and all of the crucifers, which we know to be really good anti-cancer, you know, superfoods, like broccoli sprouts, for example, have your gut turns it into sulforaphanes. It's anti-cancer, anti-inflammatory, anti-Alzheimer's. It's like, you know, the holy grail of nutrients. And also, it helps prevent breast cancer. My God, the thing is just like the Swiss Army knife of good stuff. And but they also contain goitrogens, which interfere with the absorption of iodine. So if you are an herbivore and you are eating tons and tons and tons of watercress or Brussels sprouts or wild broccoli, you can actually get a goiter because you're not absorbing your iodine. This is not really a problem for humans in the modern world. So the same thing is true of soy. Soy contains some compounds that are toxic unless, of course, you ferment the soy. And fermented soy has much fewer of these anti-nutrients. So it's kind of a common feature of plants that they will maybe interfere with the absorption of other things, but it's not a problem unless you eat a vast amount of it. In the case of ricin, that's the castor bean, one couple of beans is a vast amount because there's a lot of toxin. In the case of, say, almonds, there's a lectin in the surface. But I don't think Dr. Gundry understands the most magic organ in the body, which is the liver. And the liver likes to exercise, and it gets very good at detoxifying environmental toxins if it's exposed to things like plant toxins, which are not very poisonous, but are poisonous enough to exercise and cause the liver to make the enzymes that break down this stuff. So then when you get BPA in your system, the liver is like, I can, don't worry, and it squirts it and kills it, gets the BPA broken down into something that can't act as an endocrine disruptor. And the same thing for all sorts of environmental pollutants that are, you know, we are exposed to constantly. Our liver protects us from them, but the more practice it gets and the more different compounds at low levels, the better it gets at making those enzymes, those cytochrome P450s that do the secondary and the conjugating enzymes like COMT, which puts a methyl group on things and is, you know, absolutely critical to the breakdown of your own hormones and to the breakdown of environmental toxins, the vegetables make you make more of it. So it's kind of like you've got to understand the dynamic. I mean, exercise, people can injure themselves exercising, but if they don't exercise, they injure themselves more. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. I think that there are people who are really sensitive to certain lectins and they shouldn't eat them, and they generally know who they are. And it's like, yeah, if you get a stomach ache for every time you eat something, don't eat it. That's kind of
right.
There's an old joke about that. You know, doctor, it hurts when I do this. Well, don't do it.
Yes. Yeah. Dr. Gundry, by profession, was a surgeon and an inventor of surgical apparatus.
I did not know that.
He touts that a lot, but that doesn't mean that he's an expert when it comes to nutrition.
Would you hire would you hire a master plumber to work on your electrical box?
Yeah, right. By the way, before I go, would you just clear up what you said about soy? Fermented soy, like...
Well, tempeh and and natto is another one. Those are I love tempeh and tofu.
Are you saying
tofu is not fermented? So, just to clarify,
right? Are you saying stay away from tofu and just supplement with things like tempeh? Is that what you're recommending?
I think that the compounds that are in edamame. You want to be careful about how much edamame you eat, because that's a fairly powerful anti-nutrient. But and there's some other things in it I don't remember at the moment, but it's like, yeah, you shouldn't eat a lot of edamame. Once you turn it into a processed form, it defangs, it removes that chemical. Tofu is a polymer, if you will. Tofu is kind of like, it's not fermented the way cheese and tempeh is. Tofu is kind of like jello, you know, it's changed from the original compound into a cross-linked thing, but it's mainly done with lime. Like, you know, when you cook fish using lemon juice, they call it ceviche.
Uh-huh.
But the fish is raw, but it seems cooked because the chemical structure of the fish is changed by the acid. And so something similar happens with tofu. You can think of that as soy ceviche. It's probably the closest analog that you might be familiar with.
So the anti-nutrient properties in the bean, when you make it into tofu, are lessened?
About by 90%, yes.
Okay. So that means that the tofu... would be okay to eat.
That's right.
Because it has been processed.
Right. But it's a kind of, it's not an ultra process. I mean, just if you take something and cook it, like you take rice and you cook it, you're processing it. But you're not ultra processing it unless you grind it up and then turn it and then extrude it and then deep fry what you extrude and call it a rice crunchy or, you know, something.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's ultra processed.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for clearing all that up. I really appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for asking a question that I'm sure is on many people's mind. Have a wonderful evening.
Same to you. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long. And stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.